1950 issue. A poem, Bitter Strawberries, a sardonic comment on war, was accepted and published in the same month by the Christian Science Monitor. In her high school yearbook, The Wellesleyan, the girl who later described herself as a rabid teenage pragmatist was pictured. Warm smile, energetic worker, bumble boogie piano specialist, clever with chalk and paints, weekends at Williams, those fully packed sandwiches, future writer, those rejection slips from 17, oh, for a license. In September 1950, Sylvia entered Smith College in Northampton, Massachusetts, the largest women's college in the world. She went on scholarship, one from the Wellesley Smith Club and one endowed by Olive Higgins Prouty, the novelist and author of Stella Dallas, later a friend and patron. These were the years in which Sylvia wrote poetry on a precise schedule, circled words in the red leather thesaurus which had belonged to her father, maintained a detailed journal, kept a diligent scrapbook, and studied with concentration. Highly successful as a student, she was also elected to class and college offices. She became a member of the editorial board of The Smith Review, went for weekends to men's colleges, and published stories and poems in 17. But at the time, she wrote in a letter, "For the few little outward successes I may seem to have, there are acres of misgiving and self-doubt." Of this period, a friend later said, it was as if Sylvia couldn't wait for life to come to her. She rushed out to greet it, to make things happen. As she became increasingly conscious of herself as a woman, the conflict between the lifestyle of a poet intellectual and that of a wife and mother became a central preoccupation. And she wrote, "It's quite amazing how I've gone around for most of my life as in the rarefied atmosphere under a bell jar." In August 1951, she won Mademoiselle magazine's fiction contest with a short story, Sunday at the Mintons, and in the following year, her junior year in college, Sylvia was awarded 2 Smith Poetry Prizes and was elected to Phi Beta Kappa and to Alpha, the Smith College Honorary Society for the Arts. Then in the summer of 1952, she was chosen to be a guest editor in Mademoiselle's College Board Contest. In her scrapbook, she described the beginning of that month in New York in the breathy style of the magazine. After being one of the 2 national winners of Mademoiselle's fiction contest, $500, last August, I felt that I was coming home again when I won a guest editorship representing Smith and took a train to New York City for a salaried month working, hatted and heeled, in Miles' air-conditioned Madison Avenue offices. Fantastic, fabulous, and all other inadequate adjectives go to describe the 4 gala and chaotic weeks I worked as guest managing ed. Living in luxury at the Barbizon, I edited, met celebrities, was feted and feasted by a galaxy of UN delegates, simultaneous interpreters and artists. An almost unbelievable merry-go-round month. This Smith Cinderella met idols Vance Borgeli, Paul Engel, Elizabeth Bowen, wrote article via correspondence with 5 handsome young male poet teachers. The poets were Alistair Reed, Anthony Hecht, Richard Wilbur, George Steiner, and William Burford, whose pictures were accompanied by biographical notes and comments on poets and poetry. After 230 odd pages of advertising, the bulk of the August 1953 college issue was introduced by Sylvia as guest managing editor with Mademoiselle's Last Word on College 53, under a vapid picture of the guest editors holding hands in star formation, dressed alike in tartan skirts with matching Eton caps and open-mouthed smiles, she wrote. "We're stargazers this season, bewitched by an atmosphere of evening blue. Foremost in the fashion constellation, we spot Mademoiselle's own tartan, the astronomic versatility of sweaters, and men, men, men. We've even taken the shirts off their backs. Focusing our telescope on college news around the globe, we debate and deliberate. Issues illuminated, academic freedom, the sorority controversy, our much-labeled and libeled generation. From our favorite field, stars of the first magnitude shed a bright influence on our plans for jobs and futures. Although horoscopes for our ultimate orbits aren't in yet, we guest eds are counting on a favorable forecast with this send-off from Mademoiselle, the star of the campus." No doubt she was more pleased with page 358, Mademoiselle finally published Mad Girl's Love Song, My Favorite Villanelle. Mad Girl's Love Song, A Villanelle, by Sylvia Plath, Smith College, 54. I shut my eyes and all the world drops dead. I lift my lids and all is born again. I think I made you up inside my head. The stars go waltzing out in blue and red. An arbitrary blackness gallops in. I shut my eyes and all the world drops dead. I dreamed that you bewitched me into bed and sung me moonstruck, kissed me quite insane. I think I made you up inside my head. God topples from the sky, hell's fires fade. Exit seraphim and Satan's men. I shut my eyes and all the world drops dead. I fancied you'd return the way you said. But I grow old and I forget your name. I think I made you up inside my head. I should have loved a thunderbird instead. At least when spring comes, they roar back again. I shut my eyes and all the world drops dead. I think I made you up inside my head. That summer, too, Harper's Magazine paid $100 for three poems which Sylvia identified as first professional earnings. Later, assessing these bubbling achievements, she wrote, "All in all, I felt upborne on a wave of creative, social, and financial success. The six-month crash, however, was to come." There were the events which took place in her life in the summer and autumn of 1953, at the time of the electrocution of the Rosenbergs, at the time when Senator Joseph McCarthy was forcing his power, at the beginning of the Eisenhower presidency. These were the events which Sylvia Plath reconstructed in The Bell Jar. Years later, she described the book she wanted to write. The pressures of the fashion magazine world, which seems increasingly superficial and artificial, the return home to the dead summer world of a suburb of Boston. Here, the cracks in her, the heroine Esther Greenwood's, nature, which had been held together, as it were, by the surrounding pressures of New York, widen and gape alarmingly. More and more, her warped view of the world around her, her own vacuous domestic life and that of her neighbors, seems the one right way of looking at things. For Sylvia, then came electroshock therapy, and finally her well-publicized disappearance, subsequent discovery, and consequent hospitalization for psychotherapy and more shock treatment. She wrote, "A time of darkness, despair, disillusion, so black only as the inferno of the human mind can be. Symbolic death and numb shock, then the painful agony of slow rebirth and psychic regeneration." Subsequently, Sylvia returned to Smith College and reconquered old Broncos that threw me for a loop last year. At the beginning of the next summer, she wrote that a semester of reconstruction ends with an infinitely more solid, if less flashingly spectacular, flourish than last year's. By the end of the next academic year, she had sold more poems, earned additional prizes, and written her long paper for English honors on the double personality in Dostoevsky's novels. In June 1955, she graduated from Smith College, summa cum laude, with the prospect of an English Fulbright year in Newnham College at Cambridge University. There, Sylvia met the British poet Ted Hughes, whom she married in London on June 16, 1956, Bloomsday. Sylvia's Fulbright was renewed, and after a vacation in Spain, Ted and Sylvia lived in Cambridge for another year. Then, in the spring of 1957, they moved to the United States, where Sylvia was assessed by her colleagues as one of the two or three finest instructors ever to appear in the English department at Smith College. It is probable that Sylvia already had a version of The Bell Jar in her trunks when she returned to the States, but she was concentrating on poetry and on teaching. In June 1958, she applied for a Eugene F. Saxton Memorial Fellowship to complete her book of poems. The Saxton Fellowship had been established to honor an outstanding editor of Harper and Brothers. The trust, at the discretion of the trustees, gave outright grants of money to writers for living expenses. Agreement of all three trustees was necessary to make the grant, and one of them, who called the sample poems Beyond Reproach, noted that, "In looking over Mrs. Hughes' history, I see that she has had valuable awards dropped into her lap during most of her adult life. Perhaps it would not do her any real harm to continue her work for a while as a teacher in a fine college. My impulse is rejection, though I think the quality of her work entitles her to serious consideration. In October 1958, the application was rejected with a special letter from the secretary to the trustees, who wanted Mrs. Hughes to know that your application aroused more than ordinary interest. The talent, which is marked, was not a matter for dispute, but rather the nature of the project. Meanwhile, the Hugheses had moved to a small apartment on Beacon Hill, living on a shoestring for a year in Boston, writing to see what we could do. Sylvia had made the difficult decision to give up teaching and to discard an academic plan for which she had been groomed since childhood in exchange for a less certain existence, but one which she hoped would give her more time to write. However, as the year progressed and her book of poems was repeatedly submitted and rejected under ever-changing titles, she wrote, "Nothing stinks like a pile of unpublished writing," which remark I guess shows I still don't have a pure motive. Oh, it's such fun, I just can't stop, who cares if it's published or read, about writing. I still want to see it finally ritualized in print. In December 1959, Ted and Sylvia returned to England to live. In April 1960, their first child, Frida, was born. At last, Sylvia's book of poetry, The Colossus, was accepted for fall publication by William Heinemann Limited. Subsequently, Sylvia suffered a miscarriage, then an appendectomy, and then became pregnant again. On May 1, 1961, she again applied for a Eugene F. Saxton Fellowship, this time in order to finish a novel which she described as 1/6 completed, about 50 pages. On the application, Sylvia had asked for money to cover babysitter or nanny at about $5 a day, 6 days a week for a year, $1,560. Rent of study at about $10 a week, $520 for a year. Total, $2,080. At present, I am living in a two-room flat with my husband and a year-old baby and having to work part-time to meet living expenses. To a friend, she wrote that she was over one-third through a novel about a college girl building up for and going through a nervous breakdown. She wrote, "I have been wanting to do this for 10 years, but had a terrible block about writing a novel. Then suddenly, in beginning negotiations with a New York publisher for an American edition of my poems, the dikes broke and I stayed awake all night, seized by fearsome excitement, saw how it should be done, started the next day, and go every morning to my borrowed study as to an office and belt out more of it." In the summer, the Hugheses moved to Devon to live in a thatch-roofed country house, and on November 6, 1961, the secretary to the Saxton trustees wrote that they had voted to give her a grant in the amount of $2,080, the sum you suggested. Sylvia replied, "I was very happy to receive your good letter today telling about the Saxton Fellowship. I certainly do plan to go ahead with the novel, and the award comes at a particularly helpful time to free me to do so." On January 17, 1962, a son, Nicholas, was born. The days were divided among the babies, housework, and writing, but on February 10, 1962, Sylvia punctually delivered her first quarterly report on the progress of her novel to the Saxton trustees. "During the past 3 months, the novel has progressed very satisfactorily, according to my drafted schedule. I have worked through several rough drafts to a final version of chapters 5 through 8, completing a total of 105 pages of the novel in all, and have outlined in detail chapters 9 through 12. Then she gave in detail the plans for the bell jar. Although the novel was going well, Sylvia complained to a friend that she felt she was doing little work. A couple of poems I like a year looks like a lot when they come out, but in fact are points of satisfaction separated by large vacancies. On May 1, 1962, in the next quarterly report to the Saxton trustees, she wrote, "The novel is getting on very well, and according to schedule. I have completed chapters 9 through 12, pages 106 to 166, and projected in detailed outline the next lap of the book." By June 1962, she could tell a friend, "I'm writing again, really writing. I'd like you to see some of my new poems." She had begun the aerial poems and was confident enough to want to show them, to have them read, to read them aloud. These poems were different. Her husband has written that tulips was the first sign of what was on its way. She wrote this poem without her usual studies over the thesaurus and at top speed, as one might write an urgent letter. From then on, all her poems were written in this way. On August 1, 1962, Sylvia sent her final progress report to the Saxton trustees. The novel is rounding out now, shaping up pretty much as planned, and I have completed chapters 13 through 16, pages 167 to 221, and I'm hoping the last lap goes as well. After a vacation in Ireland, Sylvia and Ted decided to separate for a while. The summer had been difficult. She had suffered repeated attacks of flu accompanied by high fever. Another winter in Devon seemed impossible. She began to commute to London, where she was getting work with the BBC and hunting for a flat. The manuscript of The Bell Jar had been sent to the trustees of the Saxton Fellowship in the States, and Heinemann had accepted the novel in England and was setting it into type. A few days before Christmas, Sylvia moved herself and the children to London, where she had signed a 5-year lease on a flat. A small miracle happened. I'd been to Yates Tower at Ballylee while in Ireland, and thought it the most beautiful and peaceful place in the world. Then, walking desolately around my beloved Primrose Hill in London, and brooding on the hopelessness of ever finding a flat, I passed Yates's home, with its blue plaque, "Yates Lived Here," which I'd often passed and longed to live in. A signboard was up, "Flats to Rent." I flew to the agent. By a miracle you can only know if you've ever tried to flat hunt in London, I was first to apply. I am here on a 5-year lease, and it is utter heaven. And it's Yates's house, which right now means a lot to me. Sylvia took the finding of Yates's house for a sign. She told a friend that when she went out to look for flats that day, she had known she would find it. And so, with that confirmation, she began to make plans with energetic assurance. She was working on a new novel, and the aerial poems were continuing to flow. She told another friend that she thought of The Bell Jar as an autobiographical apprentice work, which I had to write in order to free myself from the past. But the new novel, about more recent events in her life, she regarded as strong, powerful, and urgent. When The Bell Jar was published in January 1963, Sylvia was distressed by the reviews, although another reader, not the author, and not under the same sorts of stress, might have interpreted the critic's view of the novel far differently. Lawrence Lerner in The Listener wrote, "There are criticisms of America that the neurotic can make as well as anyone, perhaps better, and Miss Lucas makes them brilliantly." The Times Literary Supplement observed that the author can certainly write, and went on to say that if she can learn to shape as well as she imagines, she may write an extremely good book. In The New Statesman, Robert Taubman called The Bell Jar the first feminine novel in a Salinger mood. In 1970, Ariella Plath, her mother, wrote a letter to Sylvia's editor at Harper & Row in New York about the anticipated publication of the first American edition of The Bell Jar. "I realize that no explanation of the why of personal suffering that this publication here, publication of The Bell Jar in the United States, will create in the lives of several people, nor any appeal on any other ground is going to stop this. So I shall waste neither my time nor yours in pointing out the inevitable repercussions. I do want to tell you of one of the last conversations I had with my daughter in early July 1962, just before her personal world fell apart. Sylvia told me of the pressure she was under in fulfilling her obligation to the Eugene Saxton Fund. As you know, she had been given a grant by this fund to enable her to write a novel. In the space of time allotted, she had a miscarriage, an appendectomy, and had given birth to her second child, Nicholas. What I've done, I remember her saying, is throw together events from my own life, fictionalizing to add color. It's a potboiler, really, but I think it will show how isolated a person feels when he is suffering a breakdown. I've tried to picture my world and the people in it as seen through the distorting lens of a bell jar." Then she went on to say, "My second book will show that same world as seen through the eyes of health. Practically every character in The Bell Jar represents someone, often in caricature, who Sylvia loved. Each person had given freely of time, thought, affection, and in one case, financial help during those agonizing 6 months of breakdown in 1953. As this book stands by itself, it represents the basest ingratitude. That was not the basis of Sylvia's personality. It was the reason she became so frightened when, at the time of publication, the book was widely read and showed signs of becoming a success. Sylvia wrote her brother that this must never be published in the United States. The very title, The Bell Jar, should imply what Sylvia told me, and that is what the astute reader should infer. It was the coldest winter in London since 1813-1814. Light and heat went off at unannounced intervals. Pipes froze. She had applied, and her name was on the list, but a telephone had not yet been installed. Each morning before the children woke at 8, Sylvia worked on the aerial poems. Here, the sense of human experience was horrid and ungovernable. The sense of all relationships as puppet-like and meaningless had come to dominate her imagination. Yet she wrote with intensity, convinced that what she was now writing could be said by no one else. Always there was the need to be practical, to find time for the deliberate expression of anguish. Sylvia wrote, "I feel like a very efficient tool or weapon, used and in demand from moment to moment." She had seen a doctor who had prescribed sedatives and had arranged for her to consult a psychotherapist. She wrote for an appointment and had also written to her former psychiatrist in Boston. A recurrent problem of sinus infection developed. She had fired her au pair girl and was waiting for a replacement to help with the babes mornings so I can write. Nights are no good. I'm so flat by then that all I can cope with is music and brandy and water. In spite of the help of friends and anticipation of spring, she was to return to the house in Devon around May Day. She was despairing and ill. But the poems continued to come, even in the last week of her life, several extraordinary poems. To those around her, it appeared that she had not given up. Frequently, she seemed bright, cheerful, full of hope. However, on the morning of February 11th, 1963, she ended her life. Who can explain why? As Sylvia had written earlier in the last optimistic pages of The Bell Jar, how did I know that someday, at college, in Europe, somewhere, anywhere, the bell jar with its stifling distortions wouldn't descend again? That bell jar out of which she had once struggled brilliantly, successfully, apparently completely, but of which she could write with the clarity of one who has endured. To the person in the bell jar, black and stopped as a dead baby, the world itself is a bad dream.
Hello, this is Cherry Jones, Tony Award-winning actress and narrator of the Little House on the Prairie audiobooks. As an audiobook listener, you know the pleasure of being captivated by a well-told story. You may not know that children who listen to audiobooks enjoy academic benefits as well. Hearing stories read aloud helps children reinforce important fundamental elements of reading readiness and reading comprehension, two key elements of overall success in school. When children listen to recorded stories, they hear and learn new vocabulary, and they practice active listening skills. Children can also listen up. Advanced readers can find challenging and complex stories. Delayed readers can listen and enjoy the story as a whole before breaking it down into smaller pieces. For all children, hearing a good book encourages a lifelong love of literature and reading. So, when you consider what to listen to next, why not also think about the pint-sized listeners in your life and select from one of the many available children's audiobooks?
We hope you've enjoyed this program from Harper Audio. For more information about the broad range of titles from Harper Audio, Harper Children's Audio, and Cadman, please visit us at our website at www.harperaudio.com. You can also call 1-800-331-3761. Thank you for listening.